Good morning. Today's topic is the America of Vivekananda's times. Now, when we think about America, we are talking about a country of continental size, inhabited by Europeans in the early stages from 17th century onwards, and then of course by people from all over the world. What used to be 13 colonies later became a united economic military superpower, an imperial power. A colony became an imperial power in its own terms, and Great Britain ended up being Little England, as it happened in recent times. Democracy, freedom of will, innovation, dignity of labor, social security, free enterprise, enormous resources, human resources, manpower resources, a tremendous organizing skill, a perfect, foolproof law enforcement system. These are various aspects of America as a unique socio-economic political experiment that we normally think about when we talk about America. But what we are concerned with is something totally different. We are concerned with the cultural and religious landscape of America in the late 19th century, especially during the last few decades of 19th century, when Swami Vivekananda happened to come to this country. That's what we are actually concerned with. So when we talk about America in the last two or three decades of 19th century, we can see many great thinkers, mystics, philosophers who shaped the intellectual landscape of the country, mostly in the East Coast, and of course in the Midwest, maybe much less in the deep southwestern coastal states. America was still somewhat Eurocentric in its intellectual preoccupation. If you read Vivekananda's lectures and America's response to Swami Vivekananda's lectures, you are struck by the high intellectual fervor displayed by great men, thinkers, mystics, and philosophers who happened to lead the intellectual life of this country in those times. So there are six great Americans, of course not all of them Americans, some of them Europeans, whose thoughts and ideas influenced the cultural and intellectual landscape of the country at that time. We have to begin with Max Müller, Paul Deussen. They were great German Indologists who actually devoted their whole lifetime to study Sanskrit, to study the Vedantic literature in Sanskrit language, and whose influence was strongly felt among the intellectual elite of this country, especially in the Midwest and the East Coast universities and academic circles. Then we had great men like Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, and along with that, the great theosophists, the teachings of Blavatsky, Alcott, Annie Besant, the Christian Science movement, and so on. But these six men dominated the scene by influencing the intellectual elite of the country And they actually prepared the ground to receive Swami Vivekananda's message. It is said that, you know, one of the great American thinkers of those times, Ingersoll, is said to have made the statement that if Vivekananda had come 50 years earlier, he would have been persecuted, he would have been hanged as a heretic. These are the words from a great American thinker. But then, what was the cultural landscape going deeper? It is said that right from the beginnings of 19th century, Vedantic ideas had already started influencing great American mystics and thinkers like Emerson and later on Thoreau, Whitman, and others. So they actually prepared the ground for America to receive Swami Vivekananda. Now, what was Vivekananda's message to which they responded? Vivekananda's message was the message of a paradigm of religion which was universal, which did not center around the concept of a creator God, who believed in experience as the last stage of spiritual evolution, and again, which accepted the fact that every religion, if properly practiced, can be a path leading to the highest spiritual realization. Now, this was a total and complete contrast to what the mainstream Protestant Americans have been taught or were used to as they listened to the sermons in the pulpits of this country. So, when, if you ask the question why America responded the way it responded, and why European countries, with much longer tradition and acquaintance with the Sanskrit language, and with its long monastic intellectual tradition, had much more intense and deeper concept of intellectual enterprise, in contrast to this rather the relative superficiality of the New World. If you ask the question why America responded with much greater enthusiasm to Vivekananda's message than perhaps Europeans did, there's the real explanation, that the answer lies in the uniqueness of the American nation. Total freedom from the conservatism, national conservatism, and religious conservatism. Of course, I know I could be challenged when I make these statements. Relatively speaking, that's why I use the word relatively speaking. Maybe today's many parts of America today are more conservative than many parts of America of Vivekananda's time. That's the unfortunate truth. But I'm not going into those details. The point is, Germany produced Paul Deussen and Max Müller. Britain produced MacDonald. And again, Germany went on producing many more intellectuals who actually left their hearth and home, gave up their regular family life, and spent the rest of their four decades of their lifetime to study Sanskrit, like Max Müller, for example, or Paul Deussen, who went to India and sat at the feet of Sanskrit Pandits and studied Sanskrit. He's supposed to be the greatest Sanskrit scholars the Western world has produced. But then the response of a nation or a people to this unique message, if you take that into consideration, there was something unique about America. Because the country, by virtue of its origin, was free from the nationalistic or national conservatism. We know the Germanic people or the French, the Franco, the Gallic people or the Anglo-Saxon identity or the Iberian identity. You know, they were, Americans were totally free from this national conservatism, which always influenced the thinking of the common man and woman in contemporary Europe of those times. So that's one of the reasons why these 7,000 people, in the words of the historians of the Parliament of World Religion of 1893, 7,000 people stood at their feet and appreciated Vivekananda's words when he uttered the words, "Sisters and Brothers of America," which perhaps would not have happened in Europe because they were listening to this too much more endearing terms from their own pulpits, both Catholic and Protestant and Anglican church pulpits. So this freedom from national conservatism and relative freedom from religious conservatism. I know I have to use some modifiers, qualifiers, some limiting adjuncts when you use these terms, but then relatively speaking, there was very much a liberal attitude which shaped the mindset of 19th century America. Again, the influence of Charles Darwin, the social Darwinism, which gave, they say, it gave a moral basis to even big businesses. The idea that God did not create this world just 6,000 years back, and the ability and the willingness and the courage to question creationism. This was some of the influencing factors which prepared the American elite, intellectual elite, to listen to Swami Vivekananda and appreciate Swami Vivekananda. Of course, we can also add many more factors. As I mentioned, the intellectual elite in the East Coast in the late 19th century was exclusively, more or less, Eurocentric. So the influence of not only Darwin, Spencer, and Max Müller and Dewison, but also the influence of Karl Marx and Engels, the socialist thinking, the humanism, the evolution from utopian socialism to communism and socialism, taking into consideration the needs and demands and the realities of the common man and his life in the street. So that also gave color to the to the totality of American mindset in the 19th century. Now, when I use these words, I want to explain a few things. When we use the word communism and socialism today, we are unfortunately prejudiced by what happened in 1917 in Russia and what happened in China, Vietnam, Indochina later on. But in the late 19th century, these terms were used among the European intellectuals and even today in Oxford and other universities to mean a socio-economic political theory, not a political ideology, but a political theory, like John Locke and others. So that should be kept in mind. So you find in Vivekananda a sentence like, "I'm a socialist not because it's a perfect system, but because half a loaf is better than no bread." Here, he's a humanist who's speaking, as he's a religious man who meditates, he's a prophet, and he's talking about this. So he's talking about a need to distribute wealth among the common people, not as a political ideologue, but as a humanist, very much like Robert Owen, Sigmund Freud, and the utopian socialists who were also humanists, or later radical humanists. So these ideas, humanistic ideas, philosophical ideas, and then the transcendentalist ideas coming from Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, and others, prepared the intellectual elite of America to listen to a message that came from a far-off country, which their own church leaders would have contemned, which really contemned. Say, the ultra-Calvinist Protestant conservatism won't tolerate one word of religious tolerance or the idea that there could be truth in other religion. It was, even as an idea, it was intolerable in those days. But in America, they are listening to Vivekananda. He said, for example, he talked about a God who is present in all living beings, even in the hearts of those who denied his ontological reality. Now, how do you contrast this to other belief systems which Americans in those days were listening to or talking about, or familiar with? A God who would condemn you if you don't accept his ontological existence. A God is so miserable that he would feel miserable if you tell him, well, you don't exist. But here, Vivekananda came and he expounded these Upanishad messages, which talked about a God who is present as a divine spark in everyone, in everything. And also, he established the idea of the spiritual brotherhood, the spiritual oneness or unity of humanity. The idea that humanity is one spiritual family. This also was a new idea when it came from there. As I mentioned earlier, Emerson had already started writing about this in his journals. It is said that Emerson got a copy of the Bhagavad Gita from Carlyle, who was a British social critic. And that was translated into English by Charles Wilkins and published in India in 1784. And later an edition came in London also. So Emerson got a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. So he was familiar with this. And he had already started discussing these ideas in his journals, writings, and of course, his lectures. And so also Thoreau, Whitman, and others. But then when Vivekananda came as a direct representative, not only a philosophical delegate, but as a cultural representative from India, and who belonged to the ancient monastic tradition, which actually preserved this tradition, there was something unique. That's why America responded as a whole nation to this unique message of Vivekananda. Now, so as I mentioned, these three forces came together at one time and at one place to create this epoch-making encounter. But first of all, the American consciousness, relatively free from the cultural and national and religious conservatism of Europe. Second, this unique event of a parliament of religion being held as a part of the celebration of Columbus the anniversary of the 400th anniversary of Columbus' discovery of America. And again, the uniqueness of the seer who gave this message. So these three factors. First, the American consciousness, which was created, which was enriched by the teachings of Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, and of course, eventually by theosophists who used to come and preach, Christian Scientists, Unitarians, and others, which relatively made them free from exclusivism, which was the hallmark of both the traditional conservative Catholics and also Protestants. And again, Vivekananda's unique personality as a living personality who gave this message. Third, this unique event of a parliament of religion, which brought together for the first time in human history on a single platform all religions are under one umbrella. So the history of Parliament of Religion is something very interesting. Or the history of attempts to evolve, to convene a Parliament of Religion. According to historians, the first attempt that people or delegates, representatives of different religions should come together on a single platform and discuss the religious ideas, implementing what today we call the dialogical method, was done by Ashoka the Great around 326 BC. Ashoka, the great emperor, who was a warlike king later became a Buddhist monk, but continued to be an emperor still, he convened a parliament of religion. So the Jains and different sects and groups and different denominations within Hindu tradition, Vedic tradition, were brought under one platform. But then it was somewhat lopsided because it was limited to Indian subcontinent, both geographically and also culturally. The second attempt was made by another emperor in India, Akbar the Great, who was a liberal-minded Muslim ruler, who brought into under one platform, who invited delegates and representatives of Christianity from Goa, Muslim Catholic tradition, then Sufis, mainstream Islam, Buddhists, Jains, Sikhs, and also Hindus under one platform. And then he created what eventually turned out to be an artificial mixture of teachings from different religions, which actually did not work out in the long run. And a third attempt was made in 1893 in America. And the uniqueness of that event is its influence is still continuing and is still being felt. I mean, the idea that all religions can come together and discuss their spiritual ideas based on the realization, the acceptance of the fact that other religions may be different from our religions, but still they are not wrong. They also may be valid paths leading to the same goal, maybe a different path, a different route. So this idea was the contribution of these concept of parliament of religions. Now we have to, it would be interesting to discuss America's response to Vivekananda, which gives us a clear picture of the America of those times. So one great writer, Maxim, writes, he's talking about the reaction of the conservative Christians to this Vedantic message. They were in a state of consternation. What could they do? What did they do? What they always denounced, what they always do, they denounced him as an agent of the devil. Remember, this was only a small group. The greatness of that time was, even when people were looking upon Vivekananda as a heathen, even as an agent of the devil, there were a large number of highly enlightened people who welcomed him and welcomed his message. That is the uniqueness. In order to understand the uniqueness of that response, the positive response of America towards Vivekananda's message, the fact that they accepted him, in order to understand its full dimension, we should also have a look at the opposite picture. That's why I'm quoting from this important work by a great Christian thinker of those times. So they denounced him as an agent of the devil. He had sown the seed, and Americans commenced to think. So Vivekananda gave a message, and they started thinking. You have to remember, long before Vivekananda came to America, Max Müller had already made Vedantic ideas popular among the intellectuals of Britain and Europe. Britain, of course, Britain and Germany in Europe. Germans and British scholars had already become familiar with many of these ideas. The Unitarian Church was formed in England in 1784. And Rajaram Mohan Roy was invited, and he lived for 3 years in London and gave a series of lectures. Keshav Chandra Sen, another Brahmo leader, also came. So intellectuals in England, and much more so in Germany, had already become familiar, intellectually familiar, with many of the ideas that Vivekananda expounded in America. But There was no question of a nation, a whole nation responding to a great spiritual message. It happened only in this country, which explains a lot about the uniqueness of those times. So the writer Maxim Pirigin says, he had sown the seed and Americans commenced to think. They said to themselves, shall we waste our money in sending missionaries who know nothing of religion as compared with this man to teach such men as he? And the missionary income fell off more than $1 million a year in consequence. So this is the impact. That also explains the nature of the cultural intellectual landscape of those times. So he says, the author says, and Americans began to think. So the idea that religion need not be a divisive barrier dividing people from other people, one sect of people from other people, others, one nation from others, but religion can be a unifying, a harmonizing spiritual thread. That was the uniqueness of Vivekananda's message. And that made people think. Carl Jackson says, it cannot be denied that before Vivekananda, Hinduism had no authentic voice in the United States. Not only did Vivekananda see to it that he effected a change in the Christian missionary methods, but he blazed open the doors of liberal American psyche. That is, he blasted open the doors of liberal American psyche. He made people think about religion in totally different terms. The religion need not be a prison wall of priestcraft, a book, empty rituals, and some dogmas. Religion can be a spiritually liberating paradigm. It could make us think of the whole humanity as one spiritual family. So it is said about how Vivekananda made his impact. At the Parliament of Religion, there is a report from Northampton Daily Herald. Vivekananda was not allowed to speak until the close of the program, the purpose being to make the people stay until the end of the session. On a warm day, when some prosy professor talked too much and people started leaving the hall by hundreds, it only needed the announcement that Vivekananda would give a short address before the benediction was pronounced to hold the vast audience intact. So, this response, as I mentioned earlier, explains the nature of the time and the culture of the people. Now, as I mentioned earlier, intellectual acquaintance with a spiritual message may not necessarily enable us to understand its true dimension, in its true spiritual dimension. When Vivekananda spoke, they felt that is one of the link in the continued chain of the succession, the unbroken succession of teachers who come from the Vedic times. So they considered Vivekananda as a true representative. So Sir Hiram Maxim again says, Christians saw that they had a Napoleon to deal with. His first speech was no less than a revelation. Every word was eagerly taken down by the reporters and telegraphed all over the country, where it appeared in thousands of papers. If you look at Vivekananda's the first Chicago address, he, in the first few words, sentences, he refers to some very important historical events, which are very important events in the history of world religion. The first one that he refers to is the migration of Jews from Jerusalem to India, and in fact it happened 3 times, but he doesn't refer to all the 3 migration, the waves of migration. If you believe the legend, it happened for the first time in 9th century BC during the time of King Solomon. Then 4th century BC, when the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed by the Assyrians. And then in 70 AD, when the Masada was destroyed, or the people surrendered, the Masada was surrounded and conquered by the Roman 10th legion. So during these 3 occasions, they migrated to India. And then Vivekananda says, this happened because the Vedantic message believed that there cannot be anything like a wrong religion. There cannot be a wrong religion. There can be only a wrong approach to religion. So he koye yathamam prabaddhinde tam sadaiva bhajamaham mama varma anuvartinde manushya partha sarvasya. He quotes from Bhagavad Gita, which I am not going to recite again, and also quotes from Shivamahimna Stotras. So quoting all these scriptures, he expounds the uniqueness of the Vedantic message. Now, the American concept of unity and freedom, self-reliance, and standing on our own feet, not bowing down to an external political power, authority, that perhaps enabled them to respond as a nation to this idea. After all, you know, the thirst for political freedom, if it is pursued relentlessly, can take you to a higher level of pursuing spiritual freedom. Freedom in its lowest dimension may be freedom from political slavery, economic dependence, or social injustices, and so on. But freedom in the highest sense is spiritual freedom. And spiritual freedom comes when we go beyond the empirical definitions of freedom. Freedom, as I meant, freedom from slavery, freedom from poverty, freedom from social injustices. Beyond all that, there's a higher freedom, freedom from the tyranny of our own senses. So throughout these lectures, Vivekananda pursues this interpretation, this ascending definitions of freedom, freedom from slavery, freedom from political dependence, economic dependence, towards freedom at the spiritual level. This may be one of the reasons why the people as a nation could respond to Vivekananda's message. And then finally, when you think of Vivekananda's message, we have to remember the great contributions of, I mentioned earlier in a very formal way, the contributions of the 3 transcendentalists who are responsible for Vivekananda's acceptance. First, by revealing, by focusing on the mystical, spiritual message of the Upanishads, which was really pioneered by the great transcendentalist Emerson. So Emerson perhaps paved the way for Vivekananda's acceptance in the late 19th century. And of course, Emerson followed by Thoreau, Whitman, and others. Second great contribution came from Theosophists. Theosophists were the first people who translated and popularized the Upanishads and many of the scriptures in America. Of course, before that, Upanishads were translated by Hendrik into German language, and also Duperon. They already had started translating the Vedantic scriptures in the beginning of 19th century. But Theosophists made some of these teachings popular among the intellectual elite of the late 19th century. So suddenly they realized that there is something unique and great about Vedanta, about Oriental culture. So when Vivekananda came, accompanied by P.C. Majumdar, then the Buddhist delegate from Ceylon, and delegate representing Jaina religion, when they all came to America, when they happened to listen to them, they understood they all represented this great spiritual culture which Emerson had vaguely tried to describe in his journals and his writings and sermons, of course, by other transcendentalists also. So if we have to thank anybody for the first time, for in the first place, for America's warm response to Vivekananda's message, and which response, a response that really reveals the America or America's cultural landscape of those times, then the first person we have to thank is Ralph Waldo Emerson himself. And of course, it goes back much earlier. Carlyle, as I mentioned, gave a copy of Bhagavad Gita to him, which was translated into English by Charles Wilkins and published in the year 1787. That is just after the British established this country. So America of Vivekananda's times could be described in many other terms. You know, America was already expanding itself within this country. The huge manpower resources, organization skills, management skills were already bringing economic miracles in this country. The country was expanding. It was already on the way towards economic progress. So many scientific discoveries. All this happened. But very often, beneath and beyond all this, there was another transformation that was happening, maybe silently. A change of the American psyche. I mean, a liberation from the prison walls of Protestantism and Calvinism in their narrow aspects. And maybe towards a higher realization of the true message of Jesus Christ, whose teachings were, of course, represented, were interpreted in narrow language, narrow terms, and they found in Vivekananda a message not unlike the message that came from Jesus Christ himself. So these are some of the unique aspects of Vivekananda's message. Now, after this, I want to take on another subject. That is, in what way Vivekananda's message helped the evolution of religious thought in this country? If you visit any cultured audience, if you visit any university today, or if you address an enlightened audience, and if you talk about religion in the way that preachers must have talked about religion before the Parliament of Religion was held, I mean during the pre-Parliament of Religion period, before 1893. You cannot speak about religion in narrow terms today. If you tell an enlightened audience that religion, as taught by my scripture, is the only true religion, all other religions are wrong, even an enlightened audience in a church or any religious place of worship will not accept you. So there is an instinctive, a natural, an inherent transition from a limited paradigm, a limited view of religion, to a more universal view of religion. Now, you may need not necessarily link this to Vedanta or Hinduism, but the point is, actually, this transition comes from Vivekananda's message. The idea that if your religion is different from my religion, that need not necessarily mean that you are wrong, that I'm right. That idea. You may be different. That doesn't mean you are wrong. That idea was for the first time emphasized by Vivekananda in the first Parliament of Religion. It was already hinted by Emerson. If you read the Brahma, for example, Emerson's great poem, some of the lines are almost verbatim translations of the verses in the Bhagavad Gita, the second chapter. You can find in the Brahma's short poem. So Emerson had already brought many of these ideas. If you read Brahma, and you can find many of those two, three verses are almost verbatim translations of the verses from the Bhagavad Gita second chapter. I already discussed the subject in one of my lectures on the earlier session. And again, if you read the teachings, if you listen to the teachings of Ingersoll, later, of course, of Whitman and Thoreau, you find many of these ideas. But when these ideas came from Vivekananda, it had a different impact. In fact, the lectures of the Buddhist scholar who came from Ceylon, the Jain scholar who came from India, they're also very grand lectures. But still, they did not have this impact. The difference in impact was due to the difference in the spiritual stature of the speaker. Vivekananda was essentially a man of experience. So the idea that experience is the last criterion of spiritual realization, spiritual evolution, was a unique message that came from Vivekananda. And this experience is possible in all traditions, in all religions, if you follow the essential central teachings of those religions, scriptures. So the idea of spiritual universalism, spiritual humanism, the idea that humanity is spiritually one, it came from Vivekananda. And America could respond to it because the great transcendentalists have prepared the ground for it. Another, as I mentioned, it is a part of this, the idea of religious pluralism and religious universalism. As I mentioned earlier, experience is the last criterion of religious evolution, Vivekananda says. And he, in one of his writings, explains this. If you look at the evolution of any spiritual seeker, there are 3-4 levels: the rituals, mythology, theology or philosophy, and finally experience. Vivekananda says, at the level of mythology, rituals, or even philosophical ideas and dogmas, there cannot be unity, a perfect unity or harmony among different religions, because there could be total difference, complete difference at the level of rituals and mythology. There may be common factors. At the level of philosophy and theology, there could be some common factors, but still there will be differences. When we reach the experience level, which transforms us from religion to spirituality, then you find beyond and beneath the differences, there is perfect unity and oneness of spiritual experience. And this is what really makes a person a mystic in Christian tradition, maybe a saint in Hindu Vedantic tradition. So some of the modern scholars have explained this message of Vivekananda with the help of an illustration. And that you find quoted by a great American thinker. If you are trying to climb a hill, you can see in front of you just one trail, one track, one road that will take you to the top of the hill. When you follow that track, that trail, walking through that trail, you think that's the only road that could take you or take anybody to the top of the hill. But when you reach the top of the hill, then you look down, then you find so many roads, so many paths leading to the same summit, the top of the hill. The top of the hill is the experience in religious evolution, spiritual evolution. The roads, the trails correspond to different mythologies, different parables, rituals, even philosophical or theological dogmas. But when you reach experience level and look down, you find there are so many roads that people, various temperaments, take to reach the same summit. This illustration is given by a great thinker, a Western thinker, to explain one illustration that Vivekananda gives in the first Chicago address itself as a classic example and a philosophical foundation for the dialogical approach in interreligious conversations, interreligious, interfaith harmony. That's what he says. So the idea that at experience level, we not just believe in, but experience the reality of spiritual unity of creation and the spiritual brotherhood of humanity. Ye thamam pravadyante tam sthathaiva bhajamyaham mama varma anuvartante manushya partha sarvas. It is a verse in the Gita. It's Vivekananda doesn't quote in Sanskrit, but he translates in English. That's how he's concluding his Chicago lecture, just before the last paragraph, if I. Ye thamam prabadyante tam sadaiva bhajamyaham mama varma anuvartante. People follow different paths, different trails, different roads, depending upon their own temperament. If they are sincere in following that particular track or trail, which they adopt, which they accept, which they can use as a means to reach the top of the hill, if they are sincere, they will reach there. When they reach the top of the hill, not only they will realize the unity of existence, because they realize so many people of various temperaments taking so many different trails with the sole purpose, with single purpose of reaching the top of the hill. The top of the hill corresponds to spiritual experience. So if you can look upon experience as the one criterion of spirituality, then there could be peace and harmony. In fact, this peace and harmony was one of the central messages of Vivekananda's teachings, which naturally people responded to. See, when we listen to a person who appears to be a good person, who doesn't have his own axe to grind, his own selfish motive, and he speaks about good things which would be good, obviously good for everyone, then the natural goodness in our hearts will prompt us to respond positively, unless our views are colored by prejudices. So prejudice is frequently defined. See, I'm wrong, you are right, but still I accept my path. I'm wrong, you are right, but still I stick to my path. This is called prejudice. So unless our views are prejudiced, naturally, every good person will naturally, instinctively respond to a good, holy idea coming from a saint who doesn't have anything to achieve. That's why about Vivekananda, one very well-known senior Swamiji of Ramakrishna Order said, the beggar who gave more than what he received. That's how a well-known Swami defined Vivekananda's message. And also America's response to Vivekananda's message. A beggar who gave more than what he received. Vivekananda was a monk, you know. He didn't have his own property. But he gave such a great message. And naturally, a nation which was taught to believe in its own destiny, which was essentially free from the shackles of national and religious conservatism of Europe, from where, of course, they came, but they came to get out of this trap, this prison house. So naturally, they responded because they wanted freedom. The way they wanted freedom from King George III, they wanted freedom from this cultural and religious conservatism. And here is a great saint coming from a far-off land who talks about spiritual freedom. who talks about spiritual universalism, who talks about the whole humanity being a spiritual family. We need not hate others because the other person worships in a different way. He worships God in a different way. He goes to different kind of place of worship. He reads a different kind of scripture. For that reason, I need not hate him. I need not consider him as an agent of the devil. He also is following my God. He also is praying to my God, to whom I pray in my way. And he has every right to follow and pray in his own way. That thirst for political freedom, which made the 13 colonies fight, that thirst for political freedom was elevated, sublimated to a higher thirst for spiritual freedom. And when a man like Vivekananda appeared before the people, naturally they responded. So thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.